Hey, folks. It is now 6:02 p.m., and it looks like there is a quorum, so I'd like to kick it off to Kyle Potter, who right now is our vice chair, so we'll be running the meeting today.
Thanks, Kim. Welcome, everybody. Let's start with a quick roll call of who's all here from the commission. So I'm present. It looks like we have Alan. I haven't seen Simone yet. Oh, look, there she is. Rich is here. Tim is here. Is Jason here? Don't see Jason on the participants list. And Derek is here. Joe is here as well. So that's our quick roll call. And then I'm going to also make a motion to amend the agenda for this evening and add a section, probably I'm thinking sometime around the subcommittee section, about electing a new chair since our previous chair has resigned from the commission, and then also possibly doing a vice chair as well. So if someone is able to second that motion, then we can discuss.
I'd be happy to second that.
Thanks, Joe. And I'm assuming that everyone else is okay with adding that to the agenda. Okay, hearing no issues with that, let's move on to approval of last meeting's minutes. Everyone should have gotten those from Kim in their emails, and I'll make a motion to approve the minutes as presented in our emails.
I'll second. Alan seconds.
Okay, we got a second. Perfect. Anyone want to add anything to that? Okay, hearing nothing, let's move on to updates. We're going to start with Clark County Public Health and the Solid Waste Program.
Do I need to say yield my time? Most of our large program updates will be provided throughout the agenda. We're going to hear from Pete Dubois, one of our outreach folks, who's going to speak to how we've adjusted during the pandemic, and share some resources with all of you to take a look at. And Jessica is going to be presenting our special waste project findings and the reports there. And I'm going to be updating everybody on the 2021 projects and including some what the SWAC engagement and roles for those will look like. So I'm going to go ahead and just yield my time and turn it back over to Kyle to move on down the agenda, since a lot of our updates are going to be provided in the agenda. So.
Perfect. Thanks, Travis. Then moving on, we have solid waste enforcement.
Hey, everyone. Nice to see you all again. I'm Brian, solid waste enforcement manager. I have a few things to talk to you about tonight, and I talked to Kim. She assured me I have enough time, so if I do go over in time, Kim, please stop me. First update is the quarter four report came out. The last SWAC meeting, I think I told you there was a few changes with the way we're conducting inspections because of COVID. They're no longer unannounced. Melissa's reaching out and scheduling visits with all the facilities. That's probably the biggest difference. She is able to maintain distance and safety measures while she's out on site, and everyone's been really compliant with that. So we've had really no concerns for her safety while on site. She conducted the 11 permitted facility inspections. We had two applications approved that were long awaiting. That is, let me pull my note up here. We have Columbia Rock and Rochi's East County Materials. If you'd like more information on what those approvals are, I can get back to you on that, but that's Melissa's wheelhouse. And then an interesting thing that came up, we had one complaint while Melissa was on site at Hagen Shaw. She noticed there was a dozen, two dozen open container barrels that were on site in the open air, full of water, oil, and some pretty nasty stuff. So she talked to them on site, wasn't able to get a response, a quick response. So we referred it to our local source control gentleman, Kevin. He went out on site. By the time they got there, it was all cleaned up. Well, it was gone, we should say. We referred them to Burlington Environmental to take care of it. There didn't appear to be any spills or anything, so we're hoping that they didn't just dump the barrels, but we've been keeping a close eye on them just to make sure that that isn't happening, or trying to prevent it from happening again. But any questions about the quarterly update? That was pretty quick and dirty. Okay. So I was hoping to talk to you guys earlier about this, but fees. The fee ordinance came about. Solid waste enforcement fees are increasing by about 30%, and I want to talk to you guys about why that's happening. In 2017, Travis?
Can you just help, just for the sake of understanding, can you describe what the fees are now and what those fees go towards, so that we all understand what's being impacted by the increase you're about to talk about?
Kim, can I share my screen? Do I have that capacity? Okay.
Just find your co-host.
Perfect. Thank you. So I'm going to show you the ordinance that was proposed to our council. You'll see these are our application and permit fees. Can you guys all see that? So what we're looking at, the current fee was the 2020 fee, and the proposed fee, which is now adopted by council, is the 2021 fee. So that's now, it's now current. You can see there's about a 31-32% increase on all of this. This fee should have gone up. This should have seen this increase in 2020. The reason we didn't, was there was, we'll call it a miscalculation in the projected numbers. So what goes into this, the solid waste program costs a certain amount of money. That money is weighed against what we get from the revenue. And so we have to make projections, how many interim handling facilities come in, how many transfer stations are supposed to come in. The manager at the time that was overseeing this didn't forecast it correctly and projected about $50,000 over what we were actually going to see. And so the 30% increase, what happened was they saved the solid waste enforcement, enforcement side, fee increases from last year. I had to correct that this year, or this last round to represent what we were truly going to see. And so that's why we're seeing the fee increase now. To give you an example, there were 5 new transfer stations projected. They were 3 new interim handling facilities projected. And you guys know the process for going through that. We know 5 years in advance before anything like that would actually be open. So, I was a brand new manager at the time. I don't know how else to say that. It was over my head. I should have had a keener eye and caught that, but here we are. So these are the fee increases now. Do you guys have any questions that I can answer? Travis.
Yes, I would like to know, like, who's paying these fees and who's impacted by these fees, Brian? Because I see that there's for transfer stations, but, like, who are the people in the populace that are paying these? Who's impacted by them? And then does it trickle down to users of the system, i.e. the public?
I would imagine we don't have that direct communication with the transfer stations, but I would imagine they're a business. So if their fees go up, it may it would more than likely trickle down to the fees that they're charging on site. But that's not a part of the conversation we're having. I think the few calls I've received already are from some of our closed landfills that are keeping a close eye on the money that's going out the door. And so they had some concerns about that. I haven't talked to any of our transfer stations yet, but I imagine I'll be getting calls since, their permits are, they're going out the door here soon. So they'll be getting notices for their permit fees. The first three, the applications, we don't anticipate any of those. They're on the books for if and when those happen.
So these fees are already approved. The council has approved these?
Yeah, these were approved in November.
And they're in effect now?
Correct, yeah.
So what do you want from us?
Just giving you a heads up. This is an opportunity to take stabs at me for not getting this to you sooner. So
we usually wait until you're off the line to do that.
Okay. All right.
It's recorded, Brian, so you can go watch it later. In an ideal world, Brian, would there be any engagement with this group? And again, this is not poking barbs at you while you're here. Again, like Tim said, we'll wait till you're long gone. In future, you know, given Slack's engagement with the enforcement side of this, in an ideal world, would this process look different, and would you have Slack involvement on this type of a process?
Yeah, normally I would have these proposed numbers to you in the last Slack meeting of the year. That was put off because council, everything was really just delayed because of COVID. I was going to get these to you last quarter. We didn't have a meeting. I did think about the idea of sending it out to you, but I thought there would be some more questions, and it deserved more of an explanation as to why we landed on the numbers we did and the increase.
Okay.
So this next year, because we have an annual budget cycle, I'll be proposing, I'll be putting forward the projected numbers, which aren't going to change from now, just 11 permitted facilities for the permits. But I should hopefully have our proposed ordinance, our finalized proposed ordinance to you the second or third SWAC meeting. And then that'll be before that goes to council. So you'll have an idea of what we're moving forward with. Rich?
I've got a question.
Yeah.
So I know that some of your funding comes from Department of Ecology grants. Is that changing this year, or will that, what percent of your total revenue do you get through that funding source?
This is actually a new application year, so we'll be applying for a new biennium. That grant or that contract starts in June. We apply for, sorry, if you can hear that. We apply for about $160,000, $170,000, and that covers, I'd say, 80%. We apply for as much as we can to cover the total cost, but we're rarely awarded that. The remainder of the funds comes from some general funds. Our finance guy, Jeff, finds the money in the department to cover the full cost of the program. But the majority of it does come from that ecology.
Great. Grant. Thanks.
Okay, I will move on to some other topics. There was an interesting, so you all know that we're doing a code update. Thank you again, everyone. We had some really great participation from your group. We sent the review out to some of our stakeholders in the community, industry folks. I extended the deadline for that to have comments back by the 15th. And so once we get that, we reached out to folks like Clark Conservation District has been a really big help for our animal waste handling. Reach out to our transfer stations, some of our exempt facilities. So we're hoping, I haven't dove into the comments yet, but we're having a pretty decent return. So I'll update you guys at the next meeting on what kind of comments we're seeing and what changes we have to make based on that. Following that, we would go out for public comment. So that's a really exciting step, a big step, and we're hoping I'd like to tap into you and your ideas on what groups we should send it out to. We want to, of course, get this as the biggest breadth of population as possible to weigh in on this. But in that process, we started talking about the idea of where should human waste fall, or not human waste, human remains. I'm sorry. Should human remains be a topic that we even talk about in solid waste? Talking to the Department of Ecology, internal conversations, we thought it'd be insensitive to in any way consider human remains a part of solid waste. The Department of Ecology backed us up on that. But we had an interesting conversation with Community Develop last week about a company called Recompose, who's proposing a Clark County facility. What they are, individual pods. Think of the process of composting. You have your own individual pod. You're in there with bark chip, alfalfa at a certain temperature, a certain humidity. 1 month later, the buzzer goes off and you are a 1 cubic yard of soil, clean soil, essentially. So it's a neat process. The plot of land that they're proposing to do it on that they already own is not zoned for a crematoria or cemetery, which this is currently, it's the county council's belief that that is what it should be cited as. And so they proposed that they would be a solid waste facility. And so that got the conversation started. Not just the solid waste. It would be ancillary to an already permitted activity, and so they were trying to be an exempt facility as a composting facility. But the end product, they are going to be about 600 cubic yards. So the beginning product is going to be much more than that 1,000 cubic yards that they would need to be exempt. They need to be under 1,000 cubic yards to be exempt. So even if we did consider it, they would have to be a permanent facility with the volume they're talking about having on site at any one time. But it came down to ecology would not support that kind of application coming through. So that is kind of where we stand. Do you guys have any questions about it?
So many questions.
So you can't really be put under the community rose garden.
Well, just don't tell anybody.
This is recorded, Brian.
I know.
I'm just kidding.
That's okay.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
So our policy advisor for the county is looking at amending some codes to see requirements to see if they could rezone or include something, redefine this kind of business as not a crematory or a cemetery, because looking at the process, it really is composting. I mean, that's the process that's happening. It's not in the ground. It's in an enclosed facility. Again, the company's called Recompose. They have a website already established and a mock of what they would like to have in Clark County. So
their next step moving forward, they're working with the county on trying to be rezoned, or what's the, I guess I'm a little bit confused.
They are going back to the drawing board. We left the last meeting with them that solid waste was not an option. So solid waste will probably be at the table again at the next one. It's a 700-acre parcel that they own, that is going to be owned by a nonprofit. During the meeting, one of the community development folks found that a section of that 700 acres is actually zoned. It's R10 that would allow for a crematoria. And so they're going to see if they can trade lots, essentially, see if they can get onto a piece of property that would allow, which would solve all of our problems. So we'll have another meeting, I'm hoping, in a couple of weeks, and they'll tell us whether or not that is a possibility. But the county's perspective is they don't want to not allow this industry to move forward because of the zoning and what we're calling this business.
Would you, in your opinion, or your understanding, and not to be insensitive, understanding that the idea is that referring to human bodies as similar to any other type of waste in our code, do you feel like it naturally falls into any other similar code that we have? Like, do you feel like if we were going to put it in solid waste code, it would have a place somewhere around animals, or, you know, does it have a home?
Yeah. Insensitivity aside, I think we could make it fit. I think it would, the material would be classified as feedstock under the state's definition. It's just the state is taking a very strong stance that they don't want anything to do with this. So if it came back to us and we could find a way to make it work, I think we could. Southwest Clean Air Agency was all over them in their first facility that opened up in Kent, I believe is where it is. They have a facility, and they were put through the ringer to make sure that there was absolutely no odors coming out, that their byproduct was safe and clean. And there's still a lot of research that has to go in about end of life care and what happens to those chemicals through the decomposition process, what's left, if anything. University of Washington is doing some interesting research on that to find out. For pharmaceuticals and things like chemotherapy and other such chemicals. Yeah, I think if push came to shove, we could make it work, but that's not where we are at this point.
Hey, Brian, one more time, can you tell me the name, company name?
Recompose.
Thank you.
Yeah, and talking to the owner, I told her I was interested in the process, but I'm a little young, and she told me about her other business, Precompose. So pre-recomposition. And the process is they went through legislative. They actually raised $7 million for their Kent facility and moved legislation to have the term natural organic reduction added to an RCW. So that's an actual, it's a term that talks about the process of the decomposition of human remains to a clean soil.
Don't you have an interesting job?
Don't I? I never thought I'd have an inbox titled Human Remains.
And did you say it would go in, did you say feedstock as in with an F?
Feedstock, yeah. Yeah, if you look up, the WAC, 173350 and just do a word search for composting, it talks about a table and different number, different values, but it goes into another term called feedstock. And the process of that, I think, fits closest to what the material would be, and through the composting process. All right. If you guys have any questions about that, feel free to email me. Yeah, Rich.
Sounds like a plan update, maybe.
Yeah, I can update you guys. Yeah.
No, I'm thinking it would be something we want to address in our solid waste plan update.
Yeah. It sounds like we need to pay attention to what we title the chapter and where we include it. But yeah, it seems like a good possibility, and maybe we can get our I'd like to put in a reservation now just for whatever, get my spot reserved. But
look at the pictures. It looks, what they're scoping is a pretty nice facility, somewhere you would go and actually hang out and have a cup of coffee. And but I, on the horizon, because this is a up and coming topic and there's a lot of interest around it, these are above ground pods, but the idea of composting human remains in general, I think, is a growing topic, and we should probably be prepared for on the ground, in the ground, in silos, different renditions of the same process, and be prepared to have that discussion. Okay. Thank you all. That's all my updates.
All right. Thanks, Brian. Some very interesting stuff for sure, and something to think about for all of us, I think, going forward, especially with the solid waste plan, like Rich mentioned. Okay, moving on. We have an update from the City of Vancouver. Julie, I believe.
Hi there. Happy New Year, even though it's February. I'm going to request to share my screen with Kim, so when it's available, I'm excited to share some really cool. Oh, it is. Okay. Oh, I don't use Zoom. How do I do this? Oh, there it is. Right in the middle. It's green. Okay, bear with me, y'all. The update I have for you relates to the Fall Leaves Coupon Program. And I'm going to wait just a minute to see that. I see some nodding heads that you see my screen, right? No, not yet. Yes. Okay, good. Just be patient. All right, so just as a reminder, the city manages the regional Fall Leaves Coupon Program. This is in collaboration with our city solid waste program, our Clark County Public Health Solid Waste Program to do the outreach with us, and then Public Works to pay for the county's portion of disposal costs. And before you is a dashboard. If I zoom in or out, the data disappears because it takes a while to load. But this is a new tool that we worked with in partnership with our Public Works GIS folks in the city, because our program has a lot of data. It's very rich in its data and what we can track. And it's new in that GIS offered to help us with our data. So I show this to you. Every dot represents an individual who used a coupon last fall. And so last year, the report out that I have for you is that we reached record amounts of leaf coupon redemption in terms of how many customers use the coupon. In Vancouver, we saw a slight decline in participation as opposed to overall across the region, more coupons redeemed from county households, evidenced by kind of UGA outlying cities and county areas. So about 39% of coupons came from Vancouver residents. That's just over 2,500 coupons from Vancouver households. Those are unique coupons for unique addresses. And about 61% or almost 4,000 coupons from Clark County residents. Yardage was about 9,000 yards from Clark County residents and 6,300 yards from Vancouver residents. So it's on par, a total of 15,400 yards, give or take, for the whole regional program. The cost, like I mentioned, it did grow because our disposal costs have grown over time, and it was about $172,000 for this program across all of our four vendors. We felt like it was a successful year and are grateful for this dashboard because it gives us a little bit more level of data that we've never had before, where we can pinpoint where the generators are coming from, as well as accurately track and discern which residents they are, whether city or county. We hope to refine it further to get even granular to help support even our smaller jurisdictions like Camas, Washougal, Battleground, and Richfield to know how their users are using it and to then better promote it and make sure our community knows about this free tool, a resource to divert leaves from the landfill. So unfortunately, it requires a special login, but I can share a screenshot with you and just know that we're working to refine it further to ensure its accuracy. But what it has allowed us that we didn't expect of it was to allow us to reduce the time we spend processing invoices and also filtering through who are city and county coupons that we can then split out for billing purposes. So geek out with me for a minute to appreciate that we can value finding information at this level to then better target our programs to our community. So I will, if I hit pause sharing. All right, stop sharing. All right. So that's the update that I have for you about leave coupon program. We wrapped it up. It's October through December. Just paid the final invoices and happy to move on from that program. In Vancouver, we'll be pivoting and focusing on our city-specific spring coupon program for yard debris as well as tire disposal options available to city residents, working with the same vendors. And then in addition, some other updates that we have for you today are we have completed over a full year of our organics service and the organics program available to single-family households in Vancouver, as well as subsidized lower rates for commercial generators, different frequencies and price points to hopefully encourage and incentivize participating in diverting food scraps, as well as just recently we piloted or are piloting in a multifamily community, mobile home, senior 55 plus, providing that service where shared containers or shared carts are used by the community. So we're excited to have new learnings for that and make sure we're reaching different audiences where the service is available, but just need more support to ensure it's successful and contaminant-free. And we have heard from our processor as well as West Van, where the material is taken from route and then reloaded into containers headed to Dirt Hugger. The material quality is good overall. We haven't heard serious concerns of contamination. But if and when we do, we try and spot check and really work with Waste Connections recycling advocates to ensure that we are responsive in addressing contamination reduction for the organics program. And we're hoping to explore maybe some form of quarterly route inspection as needed, just to keep a pulse on the program and ensure we're providing that quality communication back to the customers that are using the program as well. And then the last update from Vancouver is recently, in the last year, the city concluded with the support of a consultant, a greenhouse gas survey. And that was a second survey. We did one back in 2007 or 2009, Rich might recall, many years ago. And so we wanted to get a good baseline to then start engaging. Council has requested we start engaging and understanding climate work and climate reduction, emissions reductions. So in 2021, we'll be working with staff internally and a consultant to identify strategies that council will consider. And some of those strategies can and potentially would impact solid waste in our utility and program, such as targeting specific emissions reductions goals, whether that be through food waste diversion, recycling diversion, potentially fleet, EV or hybrid, in terms of how we, a solid waste utility, perform and operate and the services that we are working with our community to have. Could be something, scaled over time, but those strategies are still very high level and they will result hopefully and then actionable items underneath them that we then would roll out and carry out, such as mandatory service or changes in incentives with service. So we anticipate understanding and having more strategies discussion in this current month and then the months ahead and council consideration sometime in the spring potentially. So more to come there, but I think it's valuable to know that Vancouver is heading in a direction to target emissions reductions as well. So with that, I think that's all I had. Any other questions from you all? Okay. All right. Thank you.
Julie, one quick question for you. What percentage of people are using organics in the city of Vancouver?
So single family customers, it's been relatively the same amount of customers from before the food waste addition. It's roughly 60%, a little bit more. And that's still a subscription-based service, meaning customers are not required to pay for or have the service. And they're also not required to put food scraps in their container. It's still optional should they participate. When we transitioned from a previous yard debris program to the current organics program, we did see a decline in some customers participating. Those customers were generally ones that preferred the lower cost model of the on-call service where they could seasonally participate, but that service really truly wasn't reflective. The cost for service didn't reflect, the cost that customers paid didn't reflect the true cost that the service was. So there was a natural need to true up that. But we have seen that with the new program, we have different cart size options, 96, 64, 32, and 20 gallon. And we've seen a surprising number of customers go after the smaller cart sizes, such as 32 and 20 gallon. So they're a hot commodity. They're smaller, so they work for some of our urban, denser areas or new, like, infill narrow lots. So I don't have those numbers, but I could look them up and provide them back to you later.
So your thought is that then the people with the smaller carts are mostly doing it for the food organic.
Food waste, program, yeah.
Not the yard debris necessarily.
Yeah, and what we see with the program is oftentimes reasons people wouldn't have the service that might live in a home that could use the food waste participation or some seasonal yard debris is because they might have a landscaping service. That removes that for them or an HOA that provides that service. So, it's finding clever ways for, say, households to join in sharing service. That's something we've heard about or say like the mobile home community model where they are using and have had, collective yard debris bins and they just didn't know they could now put food scraps in it. So we're working to ensure that, we're targeting and piloting successful opportunities for those that maybe aren't fully engaging with the service, if that makes sense. Yeah. And then with climate strategies, there could be potentials like working with, say, restaurants or generators that we know are going to have a high volume of food waste in their garbage, manufacturers of food products, food packaging that are just tossing the garbage because they don't want to add that extra cost or extra step to train staff or such. It was a great opportunity, but sometimes it requires more regulation or encouragement, incentive, if you will. So,
I'll be
happy to share those if that's the desire when those are ready.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Julie. Mm-hmm. All right. I believe next up on our agenda is Derek from Waste Connections with an update for us. Hi, Derek.
Hello. Whoa. Get me down off the rafters there. Let's see. So a couple of updates in general. It's nice to be, talking to everybody in February and not talking about, response to snow activity. So, typically in February at this meeting, we, spend a lot of time, talking, defending ourselves about what might have happened and how, we can't control the weather on Thursdays. And it wasn't our fault that we got snow 3 Thursdays in a row and canceled service, but, really, it's been one of the best winters we've had. Very few service disruptions, a few things in the rural area, but really nothing of note. So, you know, knock on wood, we're out of that this year. So, a couple other things. Our offices are still operating at 25% capacity or less. So all of our customer service staff are working from home right now, with the exception of new hires that we have in for training and maybe some reps that are struggling. A few of our accounting staff, but really we're trying to keep our office. We have about 60 people in our office, and we're trying to keep that about 15 to 20 people or under. Then it seems to be working pretty well. People are enjoying work from home for the most part and performing at a good level. So we've adapted well on that front. We have, you know, just in transparency's sake, we have had, I think it's 12 to 13 positive COVID tests amongst our employees in Clark County. We have about 320 employees, plus an additional 80 contract employees. I don't know what the contract employees level of positivity has been. It's not been fully communicated to me, but we kind of tangentially know what's going on with that group. But so we're in the 4 to 5% tile or 4 to 5% of our population. And compared to like the U.S. population, which I think is about 7 to 8% right now nationwide, we're actually tracking quite a bit lower. And that's been the way it has been from the beginning. We've been tracking underneath the national levels. And our staff have done a pretty good job. We've had the same struggles the rest of society's had. Halloween really hurt for us. Everybody wanted to party on Halloween, so we lost some drivers for a few days after that. Everybody was real good for Thanksgiving and Christmas, but New Year's was a struggle. We had a lot of cases from New Year's, and I'm tracking any given day. I'm tracking about 15 to 20 people from our ranks that we're either quarantining or keeping an eye on for one reason or another. But it's a pretty big number. They aren't necessarily positive cases, but they're people that have had some form of interaction, or we do wellness checks at the sites before people start their shifts. So we ask them a whole slew of COVID questions, take the temperature before they even go out to start their shift. And so if somebody comes in and says, gosh, I got a cough today, we send them home right away. And most of those people are having tests for COVID as well. So our metrics are helping a lot. Our process is certainly helping. And it's not caused any major service disruptions. We had some issues at the transfer station, late last year, where, we had to send all of our scale house employees home, and that hurt. We had an issue out at Washougal where we had to quarantine the entire Washougal transfer station staff. Luckily, it's only four people. So we were able to bring in some staff from other sites. I got to learn how to turn on the computers out there, which was really nice, and the scales. But we made it all work on those cases. And we're hoping that things are going better. I certainly have a lot of concerns about, Super Bowl Sunday. So I'll be going in for our 4 a.m. shift tomorrow morning and talking to all the employees and reminding them not to go to Super Bowl parties. So see who listens. Volumes have remained strong. I think the mild weather, we're seeing really strong solid waste volumes in Clark County. It's kind of a continuation of the year in general. That shift from commercial business to homes. We've seen record levels of glass and aluminum due to all the home consumption going on. And then we've also seen, obviously, commercial volumes come down a little bit. And until schools and the businesses open back up, we don't foresee that changing. But it has been a strong year on the garbage volume and recycling volume fronts. And then our education team has really done a good job as far as shifting their methodology on how they're delivering services. It's been a real challenge for them. One of our educators, all she does is schools. And so she's really had to work hard on trying to change the dynamic of how she deals with things. They've done a great job. And then one last thing on the collection side, we are adding, the city of Ridgefield has expressed interest in organics. So we're going to add them to our organics collection program. I think we're targeting probably an April 1st rollout of that, maybe May 1st, depending on customer accounts. We have to do a little bit of research to make sure we've got enough carts on order to cover anybody who signs up for service. What we saw in the city of Vancouver was, we lost a little bit of customers at the outset because they didn't like, I think the issue there was getting rid of on-call service. We don't have that problem in Ridgefield. So I think it'll be a pretty smooth transition where you can just start putting food in your cart. It'll be a nice benefit for the community up there. So, and then a couple things on the transfer station side. Also, record volumes for there. People are still continuing to come in. We had I think we did 10,500 tons of third-party garbage in January. And in a normal January, I think last January we did about 8,800 tons with two less business days. So it was. It was a record thing, and I think we were up 40% on our transactions, so 40% more customers coming to the transfer station every day, which is a challenge, especially in January. And it makes you wonder what it's going to look like this summer, but we'll continue to work through that. We're redoing the entryway to CTR right now. We've done almost all of the work on the utilities, and then we're building a turnout lane to help with some of the traffic issues there. That should be done late this winter, early spring. We have to do some paving once the weather warms up a little bit, and that'll help alleviate a little bit of that traffic. We're also putting in a new nice shiny sign that we can say, hour and a half wait. What are you doing here? Go somewhere else. And so we're going to try and upgrade how we advertise things and move some of the traffic to other sites as well. We'd really like them to go to Washougal and West Bend all the time. And then the last thing is we've upgraded our recycling facility, West Van. In the last couple months, 2 months, we've put a new cardboard screen in, which allows us to glean more cardboard. Obviously, with people being home more, we're getting more Amazon boxes at the site. And so our old system was really good at dealing with large commercial boxes from businesses. And now that we're seeing the smaller items from homes, it became a real challenge for our recycling system to have as much effectiveness on that. So we put in a new sort screen that helps us address that. And we're gleaning about, we're thinking probably about an additional 500 tons of cardboard out of the material that we might have missed in the past. We're able to pick now with that system. And then we added three robotic arms to the sort line in January. We were the second site nationwide with Waste Connections to get robotic arms. And they're just simple little suction cup arms. There's an AI system, a computer that's scanning the materials that comes across the line. And then it says, here comes a milk glass or a milk bottle, and it'll grab it and put it over in the sort line. So it's been a pretty cool addition. It's still working through some of the kinks of it, but it basically, those arms collect about 80 pieces a minute versus a human being would do about 50. And it doesn't ever stop. Never calls in sick, never does anything. So it's kind of that next generation of automation. And that should be interesting to see where it goes.
And what did you name them?
Well, apparently the last chance one is problematic. So they've called that one Derek. They were going A, B, C, D. And just coincidentally, the D was the last one. And so, of course, my name came up. And I don't think we've come up with the rest. The Golden Girls was an option, I think. I don't know. I don't think we've come up with formal names, but we were told we have to name them.
You shared a video with us. I was trying to find it, but we can get that out to just for interest's sake, since we didn't go to the MRF necessarily to see it all. We can put that link in a follow-up email to this so people can see the Derek and his robot buddies in action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds pretty cool, Derek. And
Please do.
Yeah, please send that out. Yeah, I'll email it out to the group. And and then if anybody, once things do loosen up a little bit, if anybody wants to come down and see the sort line, you're welcome to do so.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
I have a quick question for Derek. I was wondering, I got to turn my phone off there. I don't know if you can help me on this, but has there been any more progress on recycling facilities, processing facilities, so we don't have to export, in terms of development here?
Are you asking like a secondary sorting facility or?
No, once the materials are going for processing, to the recycling. To be processed at the materials processor?
Mm-hmm.
Has there been, for a while there was the situation with contamination.
Right.
For shipments going to China. And I'm just wondering if there's been any more progress developing, because to me it's, not only does it reduce the carbon footprint of the waste stream by not having to ship long distance, mm-hmm. but also mm-hmm. as a workforce development opportunity. So do you know anything about that?
So, I mean, going back a couple of years now, CRC used to ship almost all of its paper, sorted paper to China or to other international markets. When China put their ban in place, China Sword, they called it, that forced all that material to come back, and we stockpiled and dealt with it. And what it also did is it provided an opportunity for a lot of the local mills to retool and reconfigure their machines so that they could take that material. In the meantime, China banning everything, it forced the recycling facilities to clean up their material. So those things kind of came together at the same time. So you got cleaner material coming out of the MRFs combined with mills and other production facilities in the United States that began to accept paper again. And so you really, at our site, we don't send anything international anymore. I can't speak to what other facilities are doing, but I know there are limited international markets. There are, I heard somebody last week told me that they ship stuff to Turkey, but they're shipping like baled commingled. They won't even sort it. They just bale it and ship it off to Turkey. And how you can make money doing that, I'm not sure, but they are doing that. I know in Clark County, our goal is to try and utilize the local facilities as much as possible. All of our cardboard goes to Toledo, the Toledo mill for Georgia Pacific down on the Oregon coast. Our paper is being shipped to our high grade paper goes to a facility in Wenatchee. Some goes to Spokane, and then we also utilize some facilities up in the Port Townsend area. So, and then all of our plastics for the most part are shipped locally as well. So I think that China ban really did force everybody to come back within the market area. So, and you are seeing some sites doing things like pulping where they'll just, instead of taking, you know, they'll do the actual pulping process here and then ship the pulp to China. So they're getting all the garbage out in the United States and I guess landfilling the excess material in the United States instead of shipping it to China, letting them pulp it and landfill the material over there. So.
That's really good messaging. I hope that's being promoted, that, you know, that ban kind of created that whole opportunity. I really haven't seen it, but, that's really good news. I'm really glad to hear that. And the other thing I wanted to say was that, I'm really impressed with the courtesy of the drivers.
Oh, great.
They've been just excellent. Just like if they see me outside, near my cans or, you know, doing whatever, and they're driving by and they're asking me, do you have anything else? You know, they're like just being super accommodating. And I just want to let you know that.
Great. I will, after I get done railing on them about Super Bowl and safety tomorrow, I'll tell them that they love you or you love them. Thank you for that. Good to hear. They don't hear that often enough. It's a tough gig.
And you said your Super Bowl party starts at what time, Derek?
We will be doing the Zoom squares at 2:45. You're welcome to join in, but it's mostly 11-year-olds. So.
No, that's fine. It was a test. I was just seeing it, and you passed. Congratulations.
I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it.
I was also going to just comment real quick to Simone's question. Part of what also came out last year or out of the recycling crisis, the Department of Ecology, there was a bill that came out last year that directed the Department of Ecology to develop what's called the Recycling Development Center, or the RDC. So they're piloting some small private grants. And the focus of that is to develop more domestic markets for some of the materials that are here, or to preserve the ones that are here. So while Derek and Waste Connections have been finding their own domestic markets and leveraging their partnerships, the hope is that they'll be able to create some additional markets or improve the ones that are here as well. So I don't have a lot of information on that. I'm not on that group, but it's something we can, once they have some more concrete actions, we may have some opportunities as a county to build on that. So we'll keep you posted there as well. So.
Thank you.
Jason, did you want to add something?
I did. It's kind of a little one-off, but one of my favorite events of the year is the Scott Campbell Christmas Wish bike build. And just want to say Waste Connections did a phenomenal job pivoting and making, did a kind of drive-through event to still make that happen. So Derek can say the amount of bikes that were donated, but I know my team picked up quite a few that we built and then delivered ourselves, but it was freaking fantastic and kind of a part of what we all do. So just want to say kudos to Waste Connections for pivoting and still making it happen.
Thanks, Jason. It was, I think we did, I can't remember how many we did. We usually do almost about 1,000 bikes. This year we had to drop it down to about 700. But Cindy Holloway on our staff handles that event and does a fantastic job. And, you know, we had a drive through instead of a bike build. You drove up, you could pick up a box if you wanted to, or however many you could fit in your car, and build the bikes and bring them back. or you could or just participate in any other way you wanted to. But it turned out to be a really good situation in the end. She did a great job pulling it off. So it's one of our favorite events of the year. It was unfortunate we couldn't do the normal thing, but really it still worked out in the end. So. Thanks, Jason.
All right, Kyle, back over to you.
Yep. Okay. Now we are going to be moving on to Jessica with her report on batteries and motor oil. So, Jessica, I'll turn it over to you. And, Jason, I think your mic's on still. If you can mute yourself, please. Thanks.
Thank you. Let me figure out my screen share. Are you seeing a PowerPoint now? So I'm Jessica Fishberg, an environmental operations specialist with the county, and I've been working on the two-year project to study different special wastes in the county. And last year, I completed studies on the hazardous waste that we collect at the curb, so that's the batteries, oil, and antifreeze. And I made two pretty extensive reports to cover these wastes, and those were emailed to SWAC members earlier this week. Solid waste staff from the county, Waste Connection, City of Vancouver have all reviewed the reports, and our teams have proposed to go through with some projects based on report findings. So the goal of this presentation is to kind of summarize the studies and then provide you with our final recommendations so you have the opportunity to give some feedback on the changes we're proposing. And I'm going to start with the batteries. So as it stands, single family residents can recycle household batteries at the curb by placing them in a Ziploc bag on their lid. And this term household batteries is basically your small alkaline batteries, button batteries, rechargeable AA's and AAA's. And I like to think of it as the batteries you could buy at any grocery store or gas station. Basically, this excludes car batteries and more modern batteries, including lithium ions, the cell phone batteries, which I'll get into more detail about later. Non-household batteries need to be dropped off at the HHW facilities at the three transfer stations. And there are a few retail stores that operate their own recycling programs for drop-off. And in this collection, recycling route drivers, they look out for the batteries on the lid. There's an example there on the screen. And they exit the truck and collect them by hand. This is a known risk for drivers because that's where the number one source of injuries can occur is when they're outside of their truck. And it's also difficult to see the batteries on the lid because it's pretty small and can be dark outside in the morning, and sometimes they're just not collected and will fall either on the ground or into the mixed hazard or mixed recycling. But still, the drivers persist and they collect a lot of batteries at the curb. And all of our recycling goes to West Van, so the drivers will sort the batteries into two categories, alkaline and then other batteries, just to give some background on how that curbside system works. And in this, we do get a lot of contamination. This is a picture of our other battery bin on a random day that I was there. It should only really have rechargeable AA's, AAA's, maybe a drill battery or two, but we're seeing a lot of electronics, lead acid batteries, tablets, cell phones. And this contamination kind of makes sense because there are a lot of things that have batteries in them, so people might think battery recycling includes this stuff too. And this program, the curbside program, started in 2003, so that was before a lot of these electronics really existed, so it was something that wasn't anticipated when starting the project. So this is a graph of batteries that have been recycled in the past about 20 years. So when we started at about 5,000 pounds, I think, for the year, and now we're over 90,000 pounds a year. So it's pretty dramatic increase. And just the quantity alone is very challenging to manage. And it's proved difficult for even just the hazardous waste contractor to transport out of West Van for recycling. It's even a lot of material for them. So handling that is challenging. And then you can couple this quantity problem with the types of batteries and the types of contamination that we're seeing, and it turns into a more dangerous problem than just transporting recyclables from point A to point B. And this kind of leads us into the lithium ion batteries. So lithium ion batteries started to be used in like the 2010s, and today they're pretty much universal in cell phones, laptops, tablets, but they're powerful and they're small and they're getting cheaper. So we find them in everything, smartwatches, toothbrushes, backpacks, kids' toys, like everything. And this is the main challenge that waste collectors have been seeing over the past few years, because lithium ion batteries are explosive when they're damaged. And it's not hard to damage one of them because it's very fragile. In 2019, we had 10 truck fires in Clark County, and that's what the pictures are of there. One truck was damaged irreparably. The others were able, they were able to repair, but even losing one truck is, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars. And solid waste facilities across the nation have experienced the same, just like more fires, and it's because of lithium ion batteries. And they're obviously dangerous because the driver will try to get to a more remote area before dumping the load to allow emergency personnel to extinguish the fire, but it's not always possible. And that guy had a lucky day, had a nice emergency out front. And this isn't just a challenge for the waste industry, but it's a problem kind of across the life cycle of batteries. So in 2018, the Department of Transportation had to create a new hazardous waste placard for lithium ion batteries because there were fires in the post office, airplanes, kind of everywhere you're transporting any new electronics. And adding that placard there is kind of a big deal because there's only 9, and adding one was a big move there and just shows how dangerous the lithium ion batteries are. And we've been trying to do a lot of education and outreach to teach people how to recycle batteries in our program. And, that's been through, you know, different social media accounts and, teaching at classes, MCR and the City of Vancouver's classes. And the Columbian has picked up a few stories when this happens. So we've been putting out a lot of noise to teach people about battery recycling, and but we still continue to see contamination and fires. And outreach will always be challenging because there are so many different types of batteries. And in my experience talking to people about batteries, it's pretty unlikely we'll be able to get everyone to sort out lithium ions. So through all this research, the conclusion was basically that outreach alone isn't going to be enough to tackle the problem, so we have to make some operational changes to the ways we collect batteries. So to summarize all that, we kind of have the risk of drivers collecting it by hand at the curb. It's just another material they have to collect by hand. We also see the contamination in the recycling. And it's also difficult to manage the large quantities just in one location there at West Van. Outreach is challenging because the batteries and electronics are getting new technology all the time. And then our battery fires is the obvious one. So after, you know, hearing all this and meeting with Clark County, City of Vancouver, Waste Connections. Our teams kind of reviewed all this in detail, and this slide just shows what final recommendations we came up with to make changes. First, we're thinking we'd like to create a satellite collection system for battery recycling. Instead of having it all at the curb, we'd have drop-off points at participating businesses. So this would be maintained through Waste Connections purchasing mail-in recycling kits for collection sites to use. And the county operations team would coordinate this program with businesses. It'd be pretty similar to Paint Take Back to how that program runs. And our second recommendation is to end battery collections at the curb in January of 22. So there are a lot of reasons why this is needed, but it's basically boils down to lithium ions being unsafe to collect at the in the curbside setting. Ending that at the curb would have some perks as well. It allows outreach to have a very clear message. No batteries at the curb, nothing in garbage or recycling. Recycle all your batteries at locations A, B, C. And this is the message that we have for other hazardous wastes, including mercury, light bulbs, paint, medications, car batteries. So I think people are used to that kind of a system, and it's time to advance into that for battery recycling. And that end date of January 22 is what best aligns with our updates to the recycling contract. So just makes it a good day to aim for. And the third recommendation is to provide outreach for this transition into a drop-off system. We'd like to have both running at the same time, get some collection sites running this year. So at those sites, we can give people a heads up of the curbside collection ending. And also, we recommend continuing support for state legislation of product stewardship for batteries, which is something SWAC has expressed support for in the past. And I expect it'll make a comeback similar to paint care that took a few years to make it through Washington legislation. And this system, switching to a satellite collection program, is what most product stewardship programs for batteries are proposing. And that's kind of how I think a few programs in Canada operate right now, as a drop-off system. And now after all that, sorry, I was trying to do it quickly. I'd really like to get your feedback, your thoughts on all of this. If you have any questions, now would be the time for that.
Kim, I sent you an email about this. Did you forward it to Jessica?
I did. Yeah, a lot of what you said in the email is kind of what the same things we're finding here. I think you said it's going to be hard to get people to sort their batteries, which I'd agree with. And it sounds like where you are in Arizona, there might be a drop-off kind of system that you've seen firsthand, which I think that's where a lot of regions are moving towards.
We use the same thing at Legacy Hospital. You know, they have half of the hospital runs on battery powered things, and they have drop-offs with the supply people to issue the batteries, take them back, and, you know, until the bags get full, and then it has to go out as hazardous waste. So that's the way it goes.
Hey, Jessica, I got a couple questions for you. I noticed in your report, the abbreviated report you sent out, that the study was done with Clark County and the City of Vancouver. What about the other cities in Clark County?
The plan to loop in the other cities is I'll give kind of the same presentation to our Regional Solid Waste System Steering Committee, and that has the public works directors from each area and get their feedback. And we kind of agreed that if anybody doesn't want to make these changes, then we don't want to have different systems in the county. We're pretty unique where all the cities kind of have the same. Sorry, my internet just started doing something weird. All the cities have the same solid waste handling with just a couple exceptions, and we don't want to have, you know, continue curbside batteries in one area and then end it elsewhere. So that's kind of where we're going to work.
You've put these recommendations together, and now you're going to present them to La Center and Camas and Washougal. Hopefully they will buy in and join you, but you got to try and sell them on it.
Yeah, just kind of give them the same information here and provide the reports. And I talked with them before about medications disposal, and they were really supportive of work that was being done to get some satellite collections for medications disposal. So I think I'm pretty optimistic about it, but
yes.
I guess just to add to real quick, Tim, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I guess I would just add that the SWAC is typically our first litmus test for anything that we're going to roll out, you know, similar to the rates, where it's like, what have we not considered? Here are the risks. Here's the evidence. Here are the recommendations. Since you represent the public and will be the ones most directly impacted, you're sort of our first litmus test stop. And then we tweak and make improvements before we bring it out to the public works directors and let them know. So typically, yeah. So we'll just to echo what Jessica has done and why we're coming here first. So
it'll be interesting to see, you know, if somebody says they don't want to do it, then what do you do? Right. It's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. In your previous slide, Jessica, you kind of alluded to the fact that because curbside recycling has been, I guess, successful because the graph is going up, 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 that's a detriment to the program, whereas I see that as a concern. My concern would be is that that chart's going to turn and go down, down, down once you get rid of, you know, once you're making people deliver them somewhere. It's just too much easier to just toss them in the trash. Do you have a concern about that, or do you have an idea of whether things will continue to increase or decrease, or how do you address that?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the things that we were concerned for. There isn't a whole lot of data about this. Not very many areas collect batteries at the curb. So I couldn't get a whole lot of information about it, but, I think the quantities part that I was talking to, it's definitely good that we're recovering that amount of material, but it's difficult to manage in real time, at one place at West Van where all of our recycling goes. And it's just splitting it up into multiple locations would help with that material flow. And it'll definitely be a large weight on doing outreach to encourage people to use the drop-off points. And when we did this for paint care or paint take back, when it diverted from just the transfer stations to around 12 paint stores. People liked that switch. So now, instead of just going to the HHW facilities to drop off batteries, you could go to more locations. And it's worth noting that this will increase accessibility to battery recycling, because right now the curbside program is only for those single family houses. There are a lot of multifamily residents that don't have access to that. And also, if they don't own a car, if they can't get a car, they can't come into the transfer station. So, there are definitely like pros and cons to doing it, to see how much material we can collect, but I think we can get there eventually.
One more question or comment, and then I'll let other people. The bottom line, I mean, you listed a lot of reasons or a lot of issues with curbside battery pickup, but I guess the one that I'm zeroing in on, and the logical one, is the fact that it's just dangerous.
Yeah. So
So continuing the program in a way that would make it less dangerous through packaging it differently or something is really not feasible. And so we need to move away from it. Would that be a correct statement?
Yeah.
And I'm looking at Derek too at some level there, because I know quite a bit about this, Derek.
Sorry, I couldn't get my mute button fast enough. I'm fully supportive of Jessica's work, and I think she did a great job on it, and that's definitely our concern. We lose a truck about every 2 or 3 years, and we certainly have multiple truck fires that we're fortunate don't result in a fully lost truck. Eventually you're always concerned that you're talking about human loss of life as well if things were to get out of control and something seriously unforeseen were to be happening. But we definitely are fully supportive of the idea of going to a drop-off system and making that work for everybody.
Derek, are the fires that we're talking about in the place where you put the batteries, or is this a fire that started in the massive amount of stuff that's in the truck?
I think Jessica made the point where it's nice that if you can get the messaging around no batteries whatsoever, because what we see typically is people hear batteries are allowed and they don't necessarily, there's different situations where it can happen, but most of the time they will not prepare them properly for collection of the curb, and they'll wind up in the cart, and then that will wind up in the truck and get compacted in the truck, and then that will start a fire. So typically you'll see a lithium battery, a computer battery, something like that will spark with dry paper surrounding it, and then that'll start the fire. We had a commercial front load truck catch fire on SR 500 this summer, right over by the mall, and it was a pretty difficult situation. It was a total loss of the truck for us, but it was a big fireball out there in the middle of SR 500. It was just not a good situation at all. It's kind of hard to figure out exactly what it was, but I think the general consensus, once we took it down to the transfer station, everything else, is they did find a battery in there. We're assuming that was probably the cause of it. And it probably was it could have been from a business, but more than likely it came from a multifamily, that we had tipped. And so if we can get the batteries, and the messaging out there that they just don't belong in the flow at all, I think that'll help that a lot. It'll take time, but it'll help.
Going to require a pretty big public education effort. I mean, the concern would be that you'd end up with more batteries in your garbage because people are just possible. You could have just as many fires.
Right. They could go in the other cart.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was going to be a point I make is, have we had any problems with garbage fires and batteries? Like, it's a little harder to pinpoint exactly in a garbage. There's probably more ignition sources available in a garbage truck, but have you had garbage truck fires? And my concern would be is, okay, I can't put it in the recycling. Well, here it goes in the garbage. Then we're going to see a rash of garbage truck fires, and we're not really solving the problem. We're just shuffling it, so to speak.
I would say, yes, we do get them in the garbage side of things. Just the frequency is much less. So certainly, we are not surprised when we have a fire and it's on a single family recycling truck. That seems to be kind of the MO if we get that kind of fire.
Is it less frequent in the garbage trucks there because of the characteristic of municipal waste, the moisture content, or is it less frequent because you get less batteries in there?
It could be that. It could be, the way the material compacts in a truck and it being with other moist material, you're right. That could help it. That's probably a big contributor as well.
I tried to find some data on this, if regions saw more in the garbage, and there are big pushes in California that they see a lot of batteries just in the MRF everywhere, and they do a lot of outreach, and they're still fighting this fire problem. So I don't think this is like the end all solution, but it's definitely an action step that we can take, and it makes it a lot less confusing as a resident, because if we're trying to tell people to take their batteries, put them in a bag on top of the lid, it's difficult that way. So these are kind of the things that we have control over, is the way I see it.
Yeah, and you know, it's not just the trucks also. We have pretty regular fires at the recycling facility on the tip floor. So when the trucks come in and they may have compacted the load, it may not have sparked on the truck. But then once you get a little more oxygen in there, we'll get fires on the floor. You know, once a week we'll have a fire on the tip floor at the MRF. So.
Jessica, one question I had is, were you able to get any research on what percentage of batteries right now do we know are being recycled curbside in terms of Clark County? It'd probably be hard to get, but I'm just curious if we end this program kind of stamping it in terms of going forward, are we getting more batteries recycled or less going forward?
Yeah, that's a good question. We did a little case study to see, we separated the incoming batteries from what was dropped off and what we got at the curb. And it pointed to about 75% of the batteries were from the curbside program. But most of the batteries we collect are the alkaline batteries, and in Washington, those are safe to put in the garbage. They're not as valuable as for recycling. They don't have the kind of crazy cadmium and lithium metals that the rechargeable batteries do. So I think we would probably see a decrease in alkaline batteries, but people generally, if they've got a cell phone battery and stuff like that, they they'll do the right thing with them for their time.
I have a question. Did you find any examples of existing legislation for battery product stewardship?
Yeah, there are some in like individual counties in California. I think there's one or two down there, and then also a few provinces in Canada are northern neighbors. I think Quebec, Manitoba, there are a few others, but those are normally designed to be, what is it called, EPR programs, where the manufacturers of the batteries have to either create or buy into a recycling program, similar to E-Cycle Washington and Paint Care right now that we have. There's also, I think in Washington, there's a big push for right to repair this year. I'm not sure if it's reached legislation yet, but batteries are a big topic in that because of electronics, right to repair. So we might, I think that's battery adjacent legislation that might get us in the right direction.
Yeah, and there aren't any bills introduced as of this year with the short session and the restrictions for COVID. They're limiting the number of bills that they're allowing. And so there haven't been any battery stewardship bills this year, but like Jessica said, we can probably expect something to pop up next year or the year after, because there have been in the past. So,
how does your PR campaign and the other things that you need to do to support this, how will that be funded?
It'll be just our outreach teams and kind of the brain trust we've got between the city and Waste Connections, educators. Clark Green Neighbors has a great website, and we have the recycling A to Z app that people use to look up recycling information. We have a lot of just internal opportunity to do this in our normal operations. So I don't think any like large grant funding or anything like that would be necessary.
That being said, we do have the opportunity to utilize some of the funding. You know, Peter Lyon is actually on our call with us. I don't want to put him on the spot, but we do fund certain specific projects or new projects or big individual pushes through grant funding from the Department of Ecology, including our regular every 2-year grant cycle. That's something we could fund through that. Or every once in a while, additional grants come up, and if we have a good project, we can apply for those as well. So we will probably seek additional funding if this is a big project or we need to pull in something outside of everybody's normal. If the outreach and education team needs support in addition to their FTEs, or we need to fund large advertising or outreach campaigns or printing campaigns, then, and it doesn't fit within our existing program budget, we would seek supportive grants and funds from the Department of Ecology first and then look elsewhere. So.
One other concern, this is Kyle again, sorry. One other concern I have is the timeline. 1 year from today makes me a little nervous just in terms of public outreach. And we're just, if SWAC is supposed to be, you know, the first people you guys are reaching out to, I'm a little nervous that we're just hearing about it 1 year and we're going to be done with curbside battery recycling in a year. I think that's going to be a really abrupt transition for people, and people who are used to that and love curbside battery recycling, myself included, because it's easy. Getting rid of it this quickly, I think, is going to be a big lift on your guys' part in terms of outreach.
What if we made it 1 year from tomorrow?
I think you could do that.
Okay. That's a great question, and I'll let the real experts handle that one.
Yeah, so since this program is part of our recycling collection contract that we have with Waste Connections, we've already began sort of beginning conversations about how this could possibly roll out. And it's always been in our mind to do a transition. So I think, you know, ending curbside batteries at the start of January 2022 is more in line with when that contract would start. And so that's when we would begin that rollout process of, you know, how the program would be ending. If I would imagine, and I haven't been imagining, I don't think any of us have, that it would just be like, oh, hey, January 1st, can't do it anymore. You know, there would be some sort of transition plan at the beginning of that contract when it would go into place if this was implemented with that new contract. If that helps alleviate some.
Think a transition period would be. Yeah. Good, obviously, and we can work that into the contract. That sounds like a good option.
And, I mean, we'll be back. I mean, this isn't going to be the last time you all see this. You know, when we start developing these plans, we want to make sure that we're not forgetting anything as far as our public goes, and making sure that we're, you know, not just in our little bubble, but there's also other concerns that you all would bring up that we'll want to make sure to hear so that we can address them, because we don't want to fail.
Yeah, definitely. Were there any other questions before I move on to oil?
I think just real quick, I just want to summarize what I've heard from the group just to make sure it was accurate. Again, huge campaign. Communication is going to be really critical. That is something we will engage with you at key points along that development plan. And while bullet three talks about a transition, I think bullet two, we just need to be very clear that it's not a hard stop on January by a year from today. But that's potentially a beginning, or to be able to tell the story more about it being a transitional period and communicating about the danger of these things. But that's kind of what I'm hearing feedback wise. You've asked a lot of really great questions, but feedback wise, does that feel like it kind of covers where you really want us to build out this plan a little bit more, or as we build this plan out, focus on?
It does to me. I mean, you're talking about changing human behavior, right? That requires a lot of, you got to beat them over the head with it a lot before it'll finally start to sink in with folks. So that's critical to your success, I'm sure.
I can see the people down my street will put their batteries out there for the next 5 years because they know that works. And they got rid of them just like Kyle says. It's easy and it works.
Yeah, we definitely recognize the amount of food we have to chew on this one. So thank you.
All right. So oil and antifreeze are also collected at the curb, but there aren't any explosions involved with those, so it shouldn't take me too long to describe. So just to summarize, currently you can recycle, or Clark County residents can recycle motor oil or antifreeze in 1 gallon clear jugs alongside their recycling container. And the rule is that it's clear so that we can identify if there's mixed waste in there, because we can't accept the mixed waste, which I'll get into in a bit. Residents can also drop off these materials at the HHW facilities, and there are a ton of auto shops that take motor oil to recycle. And the curbside program collects about 75% is where we estimated of the motor oil that we recycle at the transfer stations. So it's widely used. And jump right into the kind of challenges that have been experienced in this collection. For this study, I interviewed recycling drivers at West Van and kind of got their firsthand experiences. And through this, we learned that residents tend to place out jugs of oil or antifreeze, that they've developed small punctures in the container, and will leave like not quite a spill, but like a hazardous residue on the pavement. And it's especially visible when it's raining, kind of like an oily wash. And these are typically not collected because leaking and transport on the recycling trucks could cause more widespread pollution, and a big mess on that tray would delay operations. So the items are typically left at the curb with a cart tag for the resident to repackage in a non-leaking container. Another challenge that the drivers are seeing is that residents place out jugs of mixed oil and antifreeze together. And these can't be collected because mixing the waste creates like a less predictable chemistry than just oil or antifreeze, which are safe. They're not going to explode, but if mixed jugs are collected on accident, which happens because it's dark outside and hard to tell sometimes, they have to be processed differently. They can't just be poured into the bulk containers with the oil or the antifreeze. And they're sent for hazardous waste incineration instead of being recycled. And the last challenge is just related to the containers. We do need clear containers like a milk jug so that we can see what kind of waste is in there. So residents sometimes place out opaque bottles or non-lidded jars and just items that can't be collected safely. So they're left at the curb and tagged for instructions to give that person info on what to do with that. So some response options to this. There are a lot of different things we can do. A lot of different regions collect oil at the curb, and they do it like there's a wide scale of how it's done. So we kind of landed on these three to just continue our collections because they are successful. They're safe. We're not seeing any big dangers from this. And it's an excellent way to divert that material for recycling because it is convenient. To address the leaking containers, Waste Connections has agreed to provide drivers with bags so that instead of leaving it at the curb, the driver can put the jug into the bag, put it on the truck, and then it's all recycled and safely transported. And then the driver would probably also follow up with a tag on the cart, just reminding them to be more careful with their containers in the future. And our third recommendation is related to outreach. The report describes like those wider operational changes that we could make to collections, but instead of making big changes, our group decided that just start with maybe some more specific education about not using opaque containers, not mixing hazardous waste. So we've got some plans in the works to update the recycling A to Z, the app, and just make, you know, the information more accessible. And this pretty much wraps it up for oil and antifreeze. So I'll open it back up to the group to provide feedback or ask questions.
Do you see the collection of oil at the curb going up or going down over the past years? And I guess I'm curious to know how, I don't know if you have any idea how much of it is contaminated or not, but I could see where a lot of it might be. You know, you talk about antifreeze, but, you know, you throw, you get a little bit of transmission fluid, you throw it in with your oil, you can't tell if it's mixed or not. So I don't know how, I'm curious to know how big a problem that is.
Yeah, there were definitely some veteran recycling drivers that I talked to who, as they're pouring out the oil, they're like, oh yeah, there's a little bit of solvent in there. Like they can smell it in the air, but that doesn't happen too often with them. And I tried to reach out to the companies that we ultimately send the oil and antifreeze to, and that kind of contamination is just built into their general operations because it's so common. You get like lead and mercury, just like a bunch of hazardous slurry out of there that are just present in motors. So we try to, you know, prevent that when we can, when we see the mixed containers. So hopefully not too many people are doing that. And we do have some, I was trying to pull it up on my computer, but it is interesting the quantities that are recycled each year. This might not work, but the top line is motor oil recycling, and then that blue line is antifreeze. So you can see there are some peaks in motor oil recycling, and those were during 2004, 2008 kind of period. So our theory was that during recessions, more people do their own oil changes at home to save money, and then we were seeing just increases in the motor oil that were recycled, which is kind of interesting and might be happening right now. I'm not sure if the drivers are seeing more than usual, which is interesting to track.
Is there any messaging going on at the retail level? Do you know?
Yeah. The Oil Recycling Act that is from like the 90s put in the requirement that if you're selling over a certain quantity of oil in your store, then you have to have signage about recycling options. So that's like O'Reilly's, AutoZone, all the ones that are around here have signage, and I've spoken with them and they all take motor oil at their location just because it's easier to do that than to figure out where else people can bring their motor oil for those larger companies, which is interesting.
It'd be great if they could include the recycling container along with the product at the point of sale.
Mm-hmm.
And then there'll be an automatic place to put it in a correct container with a correct fitting lid rather than a milk jug with an ill-fitting lid.
Yeah. They typically have just the drip pans instead, and it is hard to kind of give people the right container to use. I did look around for a while to find just like, well, if I just wanted to buy one jug by myself, how much would it cost? And online it's like you have to buy 500 to make it under $10 a jug. So that is something that we were thinking about, and it's, yeah, that's one of the wider operational changes is maybe like, hey, do we provide containers? Because some areas do that in their recycling programs, but I think that's maybe the next round of contracts, because that's a big, big new thing to coordinate, definitely.
I think the standard oil that you buy, like at Walmart and that, it comes in a 5-quart can. And you're not going to shove 5 quarts into a gallon jug. So you know, there's bound to be some spillage and things there too. Also that, you take on sales, if you read your Sunday paper, it's $19.95 for your oil change. And that includes the filter, which could be another $5-6. But then they usually have a disposal fee on top of that. So that's why we're not seeing as much probably on the curb.
Yeah, definitely. If there aren't any other questions. questions or comments, I'll kind of furiously type up the notes from your guys' feedback and make sure that we keep you guys in the loop as we move forward with some of these projects this year.
I guess I'm curious, does anybody in this room use the curbside recycling program personally? Like, I'm wondering if it will impact anybody in this virtual room.
Yeah, I do. I've used it in the past, less so now, but yeah, I used to change my own oil when I was a poor, broke college student and couldn't afford to do it any other way. But I think that it is used. I wouldn't say I see it a lot driving around, but
I'm still a poor, broke college student. So I will fill one container up 3/4 with one oil change and then part in the next one. So I'll put one out and I'll hang on to the next one until the next oil change. You fill that up part way and then you go into another one. But yeah, it's great. I really appreciate it. I'm glad you're keeping it.
I think Tim can be the spokesperson that we use for the public on how to use the containers.
I have a newer Prius and I cannot for the life of me, I would never figure out how to change the oil in that thing.
Anyways, I just don't know how to do it.
Unfortunately, I think I have everybody beat here. I have a diesel pickup, and I think it uses 4.5 gallons of oil. So,
wow.
Well, it's better than the semi truck that I used to own, and it ran 10 gallons of oil. So, it's cheap.
Hope you like to drink milk, Joe.
Yeah, thanks. Jessica, I'm sorry. I just wanted to make sure that everything's clear. They are going to continue the program, you said, more or less as it is. Okay. In addition to the program, was there any talk about having drop-off sites for motor oil the same way you guys were talking about batteries? I mean, obviously, they are separate topics, but I thought, boy, if you're going to already have drop-off sites for the batteries, drop-off sites for motor oil would be great as well.
Yeah, just because of the number of auto shops that do it on their own, I don't think there's many more locations we'd be able to add unless we did like a bulk collection in maybe like battleground area. But I've heard kind of historic information from my coworker Mike that those collections kind of become a free-for-all where you put out the oil jug for people to use and you end up with everything from paint to garbage and sofas and what have you. So the retail-based collections that kind of started in the 90s is really strong in the county. I was trying to call places and ask if each of them take more oil, and I got almost 20 stores that said yes. Mm-hmm. And we're, updating the recycling A to Z app to include the locations that give us permission to put them on there. So there's definitely a lot of that drop-off opportunity, which is good because it's more accessible to more people. Because if your car's broken but you still have a lot of hazardous waste, you can take the bus down to AutoZone. Well, I don't know if they like you bring in a jug of oil onto the bus, but
right. One quick question, and maybe this is something somebody else can answer for me. Don't they also receive motor oil at the transfer stations as well?
Yep, they've got collections there, and it's not limited to household hazardous waste hours. I believe at all three, you can just drop them off with the normal operational hours.
Okay, that's good to know. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well,
all right. Thanks, Jessica. No one else has any more questions, I assume?
And okay, if you think of anything, just... you can get my email from Kim or Travis, and I'm definitely willing to listen to more because I get in my bubble, definitely. So it's been good to hear from you, so thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jessica. Appreciate all your hard work on those reports. Good job. Moving on, we are going to do some talk about some outreach with Pete. Pete, are you still here?
I am here. Hello, everyone. Lots of great discussion. I'm glad this is being recorded. I might want to watch it again. No, I'm serious. Kim, can I share here? Looks like I might be able to.
Yep, you should be able to now.
Okay. I noticed co-host rhymes with compost. So we're going to talk about that just quickly. And I know we're running short on time here, so I'll go through these and definitely have time for questions. But I get the honor of managing a wonderful program here that we offer through the Solid Waste Environmental Outreach Program called the Master Composter Recycler Program. And hopefully you guys can all see that. Is that coming through?
Looking good.
Okay. We do an intensive training each year, and we just started our class. We had our first class last night on Wednesday. You can see here with just our, I guess they're calling it the COVID pivot, by offering this in the comfort of people's homes. We've also condensed from 10 classes to 7. We've also given more personalized field experience because of COVID restrictions. So basically we're working one-on-one out in the field with 6-foot distance and masks and all of that. But we're hitting record numbers that we've never seen. This program has been in place for 3 decades, in fact. It's been managed in different spots, but most recently here in Clark County since 2017. And I think that's a real testament to the value that we offer, and also some of the changing demographics and interests in our community, trying to get back to the land a little bit, learn about your recycling, be more sustainable lifestyle. It was a little bit challenging. We do offer these trainings in return for payback hours. And we have each time our graduate class is supposed to give back 30 hours each. You can see those numbers were quite low in 2020. A lot of that's doing outreach events, which clearly did not happen. But we did have a pretty good turnout from our postgraduates. Some go all the way back to 2002 class. But overall, you know, over a half FTE that we're getting from these folks. They get unlimited hours of payback for any outreach they do for our Clark County Green programs, Green Schools, Green Neighbors, Green Business. We also work with our operations side. They help when we do our collection events and hazardous waste collection out in cities. So we really want to tap these volunteers and hopefully SWAC and all else, our partners, City of Vancouver, Waste Connections. These are an asset that we bring, and they're trained and hopefully knowledgeable. In 2020, a lot of our work was out in our field. We have 3 demonstration sites where we teach our practices to the actual folks who are getting trained. These are some of the volunteers. We also run a series of webinars that we offer to the general public. And in our spring webinar series, again, these would all have been in person live. But we needed to shift very quickly. Obviously, we couldn't meet in person anymore in the spring. We had record numbers. Typically, we would have about 30 to a class. That's kind of what would accommodate our space, and that's kind of how it typically worked out. But again, we really tapped into some of that need early on. Few lower numbers. We've started offering 2 new workshops. Recycling Done Right, Preventing Food Waste. We're still working on that. It doesn't quite have the allure of compost because people really want to get their hands dirty. And then again, good success in the fall offering these webinar series, 162 attendees. And then beginning in 2020, we also and I know Joe knows this because he helped unload these things. We started offering compost bins to the public.
I know nothing, Pete.
That sounds like that TV show from the I Know Nothing. And then we've got the worm bins that we also give out. And these actually divert quite a bit of food waste. We figure about 9,000 pounds were diverted just through the worm bins we were able to pass out through that effort. So I wanted to just quickly stop this share and then take you to our webpage, because we had to make quite a few changes along the lines here. And so folks who want to come to our training clearly can come here and look at our syllabus. But here in our workshop, we built out a new page called Virtual Learning. And so if for some reason or another you can't make it to one of our webinars, or if you want to get one of these worm bins any time of the year, we would have you watch our recorded webinar, which we were able to do through this process of working with Zoom and doing our online instruction during this past year. So all these videos now can be watched 24/7 on all of our different offerings that we currently have. And we also have quite a few of our frequently asked questions. So folks can really kind of do a deep dive. And then the other piece that we did here is we allowed folks to come in. If they want to buy a composter, they can go online and do that. That's actually a purchase price that costs $57 for the typical one. That includes shipping and transport and tax. They can also request a worm bin. Those we do provide. Again, they need to have seen that webinar, and then I meet with them one-on-one and give them the in-person quiz. So there's no cheating on that. Same with the buy a composter. We're just set up out at the Heritage Farm, and we make arrangements with COVID practices and kind of do the six-foot exchange. The other thing they can do is request one of our green cleaning kits. So we've really tried to move away from toxic hazardous waste materials and show folks, try to empower them on how to create three green cleaning products. So SWAC members, if you're interested, you can hit these buttons and request these, and we'll figure out a way to get them to you. You're also welcome at any time to come to our webinars and our trainings. So with that, I will stop my share and see if there's any questions.
I just wanted to share that after 3 years of being here, I'm auditing Pete's Master Composter Recycler class this year. So I was part of it's nice to know I'm part of history, Pete, in the one of the largest classes this program has had. So very exciting to be doing this now that I actually have a house with a yard. I can relearn how to do all of these things. So
yeah, and one thing just quickly, we do partner with our partners. And so when we do our Recycling Done Right webinar, or that chapter in our training, we bring in folks from Waste Connections. Gretchen does a great job. Certainly Josie helps support that. And then we've been working with Liz from the City of Vancouver, who's been awesome. And then our staff, Tina, is going to be helping with food waste, and Sammy. So it's a team effort. Appreciate the support, Travis. Good to see you on the Hollywood Squares.
And I think I just want to share that, you know, Pete's program is one of, you know, a handful of programs that we have. And I've been blown away and really wanted to share with everybody and get everybody a chance to see how quickly they transitioned over. A lot of these programs transitioned over to virtual learning. And not only did they switch over or pivot, as people have been saying, but their programs are thriving and we're getting more people. Obviously, the schools program is seeing different challenges than MCR, and residential and is seeing different than business. But I think all of our programs are doing some form of virtual engagement now, and they switched over very, very quickly. And a lot of them are seeing large increases in participation just because of access. So I think just to highlight some of the things that the program's been doing, Pete's is a perfect example of some adapting that has happened. So
Pete, I have a question. Since you're going to watch this again, I would like to know, has this inspired you to write any new music for your side gig?
You know, I was going to play y'all a 3-minute review from our 2020. I'll send it specially to you, Simone.
Thank you. Recycle man.
Appreciate hearing about it, Pete. I guess the question that I have is, what's the lasagna garden?
Who was the question? That was the question for Tim. You got to come to the training.
Okay.
But, you know, it's our basic approach, but it's using, what's amazing is we're actually using waste products that would be, a lot of them ending up in the landfill. So coffee grounds, food scraps that we collect out at stores. And it's a layered method, but basically what we're doing is we're building living soil right on top of weeds, grass, whatever you've got. It turns into a raised bed. Every teaspoon of that living soil, actually, if you have a cup of it, just to make it easier, is more organisms, microorganisms, than there are people on the planet. So it grows bounteous, healthy things.
And what do you think of Brian's discussion earlier, how that may fit into your program?
Oh, my gosh.
You don't have to answer that.
Thank you.
We'll put that on the agenda for next time. We'll have a larger group update on the recompost, and we'll engage with some community experts, including Pete, if it's a SWAC committee demand for more information.
More information on human composting. That's what we're all in for. All right, Travis, do you have any more project updates to give to us?
Yeah, I was begging Kim to let me kick this can down the road a little bit because I want to give you guys time to chat. So what I'm going to throw up on the screen here real quick is just a high-level overview of some new projects we are doing this year as a program. And keep in mind, I had about a half an hour. I don't judge the quality, the aesthetics of what I'm about to put up on the screen. But my goal is to show you over the next calendar year where we will be spending a lot of our time as a program. And then there's going to be a second page that I want to just give a really quick overview of the SWAC engagement or SWAC involvement on each of those projects. And what I would like to do, Kyle, or whomever is nominated chair and co-chair, is I would like to follow up and come up with a way to share this out with the group and come up with a plan for 2021 related to the projects and the engagement. So this isn't by any means meant to be a complete detailed look at all of our projects. It's just a handful of new projects that will be coming up and have some impact or be impacted by this commission. So I'm going to just share my screen real quick. And again, bear with the aesthetics. So I don't know if you can see this. I tried to focus on size and visibility, but what you see across the top is just a timeline. So this is just a really rough Gantt chart with some of the things that we're doing and how they connect. So we are in the process right now of negotiating two contracts, one for transportation and disposal, the other for residential recycling. Those are ongoing. So those started earlier than now. Those are projects that will continue in 2021. The recycling contract will hopefully wrap up in 2021. You already provided some feedback on that, and Kim may come back for some to close the loop on that feedback and give you some updates. The other contract will likely have a longer timeline, so I'm just extending it out. There likely won't be any direct SWAC engagement on that, but some of the outcomes of the those contract negotiations will be things that we bring to the SWAC, or there might be some policy updates that we will want to get SWAC feedback on. The next one down is, I hope that you're all familiar with this right now, the regional system study, which is J.R. Miller, our consultant, working on a research project to identify the needs of our system over the next 30 years. And as you can see, that regional system study, those arrows are meant to indicate that the regional system study is an input to both the contract negotiations and the solid waste management plan update. And again, the next slide is talking about SWAC engagement, so I'll go into that. This is just an overview of what these projects are. We're going to be continuing that through September. At our next meeting, you should have a presentation from J.R. Miller with some updates on the regional system study. The next project down is the solid waste management plan update. So we have a solid waste management plan. You all should have wonderful copies. Tim and Alan, I hope you took them to Arizona with you to do something while you sit out in the sunshine. But during this year, we're going to be kicking off every 5 year cycle of updating our solid waste management plan. Kim's going to talk a little bit next about an equity project that we're doing internally for our program. That's going to be an input into the solid waste management plan update. We also have some big contamination outreach education projects that are going to be happening this year. Those will also develop input into the solid waste management plan on how we're going to address contamination in our recycling from an outreach standpoint. The next project down is our data projects. We get a lot of data. We want to have a better system for all of the data that's coming into our system and how we use it to develop and evaluate our program. So identify what data we get, identify any gaps in our data, and then build a plan for how we use and report out and share that data internally, but also with our stakeholders and our public possibly. The last one is, it's always an ongoing thing, but I mentioned we have the local solid waste financial assistance grant from the Department of Ecology. It's a 2-year grant. It expires in June 30th of this year, but we begin, and then the next one kicks off July 1 of this year, but we will probably begin March or April with that planning process. And that is a grant that funds a lot of the things that are going to be, or elements that are going on above that. So I'm just going to jump to the next page real quick. So contract negotiations, this will largely be a solid waste staff. We'll keep you informed. But like I mentioned below, a lot of the other inputs into that do have SWAC involvement. The regional system study, we had a subcommittee help select the vendor. We had, I think Tim participated in the development of the scope of work and the RFP and selecting that vendor. We're getting to a point when the reports are wrapping up. So similar to how we did Jessica's papers today, SWAC will review the recommendations and the findings and votes and provide input on those recommendations. What the SWAC decides and helps us or advises on will go both into the solid waste management plan update and contract negotiations. The next one down, solid waste management plan update, I would say largely is what the SWAC was built for. This is our guiding document that projects 20 years down the road. So SWAC increases meeting frequency and participates in the review and drafting of all of the chapters. So that the drafting of the chapters will be spread out amongst our program staff, our consultant, and possibly SWAC members, but each of the chapters has to come to SWAC for review and input. And then once we have a solid waste management plan approved by the SWAC, then it goes to the Department of Ecology for review. And SWAC increases meeting frequency and participates all the way through the end of that process. I'll let Kim speak to this, but the equity project, as it will be a part of the solid waste management plan update, the SWAC will likely review information and provide recommendations. And I don't know, I put this in there before I got a chance to talk to Kim, but there might be solid waste or a SWAC participation in the development of this project. And again, Kim's going to talk about that next. Contamination outreach, it'll be similar to what Pete did. Solid waste staff will be keeping you informed until we get to the point when we want to get SWAC input and review on the outreach and education materials related to contamination. Grant planning, again, this is not something that the SWAC is involved with. This funds a lot of the work that you'll see above. But this is just an internal process, but we will keep you informed. And the data project, we would probably want to have somebody from the SWAC on the project team for developing and helping us out with this project. So again, this was a whole lot of information. I'm trying to get it really quickly. We're already over time, but I will follow up in the coming week with the chair and the co-chair to figure out a way to get this out to everybody in a way that is clear and a little bit more concise than what I shared here. So that you all have a better understanding of what's coming the SWAC's way and what your involvement will be in each of these projects. So I will stop and give a few moments for questions, but I really want to make sure that there's time for Kim and then the recruitment, all of the other conversations that you need to have. So. All right. Either people are talking while they're muted or there are no questions right now. I'm sure there will be plenty once we get, but I will follow up with the chair pending your decision on who the chair is today. So thank you.
Perfect. Thanks, Travis, for kind of giving us a quick outline of your guys' year and our year together. Kim, do you want to talk real quickly about our diversity, equity, and inclusion portion?
Yeah, and this will be real quick. I just wanted to let you all know that we were working on this project that will feed into our solid waste management plan update. So me and a few other colleagues on the solid waste program team and also some other folks from public health have been meeting on a regular basis to try to get this going. We really want to take a real thoughtful approach to this, so it's not going to be something very quickly done. We're being very intentional in how we're doing it. So our first step that we've been working on and has been to just gather information about where we are in the solid waste system. We're calling it a report card. So like, what is our report card as far as equity, diversity, and inclusion goes in our solid waste system, and really trying to evaluate this. Metro across the river has had this for a while, and King County is one that we're really using as an example. Theirs is short and sweet and really gets to the point, and that's the information that we're trying to gather. And so I just wanted to provide a quick update on where we were at with that. So right now, you know, we've collected demographic information. We've met with CRC to ask about service areas for the transfer station because our hope is to overlap that demographic census data with service areas just to kind of see that there's equitable service for all residents in our community, since there are very subtle differences between the transfer stations. And we are meeting with GIS tomorrow to do that. We have interviewed all of our staff that do outreach on our green teams. So we came up with a few questions to try to gather information from those green teams about how equity is already included and where they already have identified areas where our points where there's not a source for improvement, but an opportunity. There we go. Opportunity. And we have also talked with our contracts team, who already has made steps to try to include, it's called Weeby, I don't know. Travis has a fun name for it.
Maybe Weeby.
Yeah. Women in diversity owned businesses, minority owned businesses, sorry. And so they're already taking steps to try to figure out how to include that in their contracts for public health. And so we've been working with our internal diversity team at public health to work with contracts with that. And so we're also going to be including a section about the great work that the subcommittee has been doing on equity in the recruitment process. So that's something I'm continuing to reach out to you all on. And that's kind of where we're at. Let me see if I missed anything. Nope. No, that's good. But it's not at a place right now where I want to share it, because it's just like we are collecting information right now. It's not like all polished and pretty yet. But we will be coming back to you when we get it in a more presentable format.
Kim, how about the you use the folks use a lot of volunteers in Service to America, or you get people in training that, you know, that you don't have the government program. Be sure you include them in your demographics too.
The volunteers in the our AmeriCorps staff? Sorry, you broke up a little bit.
Right, AmeriCorps. I just remembered volunteers in Service to America is another group. Okay.
Yeah, so we are evaluating our staff and volunteers. We're still trying to figure out how to do that. That data is not often collected. And so it might be some anecdotal. King County did a really great job of kind of making some assumptions, but also gave a starting place to work from. And that's what we're mostly identifying so far in this process, is that we just don't collect the data. And so that's going to be an area for improvement in and on its own. And, you know, those are the questions you ask, and you go, oh, like, you know, we really don't know what we don't know. So that's unfortunately what we're finding a lot of. And again, so I'm going to end it there, but I would like to reach back out when we're at a next, you know, place, or if anybody wants to set up a meeting, I'm, you know, available anytime to meet with you all.
And the hope is that this would either be a chapter. It is somehow built into our solid waste management plan. So either there's elements in each of the chapters, or it is its own chapter, depending upon how far we are able to get along, with the priority being, and I'm really excited that this group is working on this and they've really dug into it, but the priority also being, what can we as a program do? We're going to identify some really large things that the county can be better at, but what can we do for our recruiting? What can we do for hiring? What can we do to talk to our public, like Kim was talking about? So focusing on what actions can we take internally as a program, and then hopefully try to create some outward momentum with some of the other programs and bigger county-wide challenges. So
one of the, just to leave it off with, one of the big takeaways we've had so far is we've asked ourselves, you know, who are the people that we serve? You know, as public employees, really our goal is to serve all people in our community when it comes to our garbage and recycling services, as well as the outreach that we provide. And so we kind of are taking a look at that. You know, if we don't have a very diverse, you know, volunteer team, or, you know, the people that are showing up to events, you know, that's an opportunity for us to take a step back and analyze how we're not then servicing all communities. So that's why we wanted to start with this data report first, to kind of really analyze, you know, what are the data points, and not just work off of our assumptions. But I want to make sure y'all get to go to bed. So.
All right. Thanks, Kim, for an update on that. And that's some really great work you're doing there. I know you're doing a good job there. Okay, moving on. Subcommittees. So I know Rich took a stab at updating our bylaws. I'm not sure if that's something we all want to get into a discussion about tonight. I would make maybe a motion that we put that on our agenda. Everyone kind of review what Rich has proposed, maybe, and move it to the meeting next time, if everyone's good with that.
You can also call a special meeting if you want to. I know that you all have talked about, sorry to interrupt. I just want to make
sure you're good.
Your options.
Yeah. Okay, so.
Just for clarification, Rich and I did that together. He did the legwork, but we both worked on that together. So.
Sorry, thank you, Simone, for correcting me there. I apologize. So my mistake. So do you guys, I guess, Simone, Rich, do you guys have any input on how you would like to proceed forward with the updated bylaws?
The bylaws wasn't really large. We were kind of like working on the subcommittee piece. Mm-hmm. So we, at the last meeting, we were directed to come back with a charter as the way to kind of say what the recruitment committee would do. So we did some work on that. And then we offered a few pages to look at how the bylaws could change for that. But I think another group is going to look at that. So we want to make sure that before we get together next time, that group, we make sure we look through that. And Kim, we talked with Kim, and I think they went out for recruitment for the two vacant positions, like in late November, early December. And they didn't get anybody. So I know they were going to do another restart on that. I'm not sure where the process on it, but so I think, and I apologize that we got it to you late. So I think it's be good for folks to take a look at it, and please go through it with critical eye and see if we can improve it.
Just so you all know, as far as these subcommittees go, at any time, if you need me to set up a Zoom meeting or help facilitate those, just let me know, and I can set something up. You can meet any time that works call, and I can set something up so that, you know, we can have a working meeting too, working on these together with share screen or however you want to do it.
Okay, thanks, Kim, for that offer. As far as the recruitment goes then with you guys and your committee, you guys, I did see that you did make that charter, and we have that moving forward in the process. Kim, is your guys' plan to just repost with that kind of input they've provided for the new, for our vacant positions?
Yeah, so the last one, we did include a more, you know, language that was a little more inclusive in our last posting. We got no applicants, but it's also a pandemic. And, you know, we did reach out to a few organizations like LULAC and NAACP, and, you know, but we still need to work on that more and figure out, you know, how do we reach out to more audiences? How do we reach out to a younger audience or people, you know, of all spectrums within, you know, Clark County? And we also have two postings we're going to do soon. I believe Simone and Derek, correct me if I'm wrong, your two terms technically will be ending at the end of next month. So we have to go out to solicit more. I think both of you are planning to continue. But you have to reapply. So my thought was that we would include it, since we have to go out for those anyways, to include the other two vacancies as well and do a huge push to get, you know, and I would need help from you all in figuring out how to do that. That's kind of where it's at.
Okay, thanks for the updates on that, Kim. Yeah, yeah, as far as a huge push reaching out to us, and I think, you know, getting us to help, you know, reach out and the groups that we know, that's kind of what we're here to do. So hopefully we can help get some good candidates. Fingers crossed.
Well, I'd like to make sure that we do continue this forward, like on the charter piece, and, you know, not necessarily tonight, but I would, you know, Rich did put a lot of work into that. And so what I understand, Rich, is you're saying take a look at it and have input, you know, if people see anything that they would like to address. But I would really like to not lose momentum on this and not let it slip by the wayside.
Well, so, I don't know if there's any interest. I mean, if our next meeting's in May, it may be that we want to move something ahead quicker. So maybe in the next 2 to 4 weeks, we could get together. Folks could look it over. We could have a discussion on maybe the recruitment charter and the bylaws. If folks are open to that as an additional meeting, we could make it short.
That'll be very focused.
I would definitely agree with that idea.
Since Simone's position and Derek's have to go out, ideally we like to have at least like 3 to 4 weeks for people to apply. And so, you know, I'm really looking at hoping to go out with a posting no later than the end of this month on that. And, you know, if we want to build in, you know, a couple weeks to figure out outreach and stuff too, it kind of depends on all of you and what availability you all have, but it might be pretty soon.
So, Kim, would it be possible maybe to send out some kind of doodle poll then of gauging interest on who would like to participate and then what times would work for people? So, and get that out sometime maybe next week, and people could respond, and whoever's interested, feel free to jump in. And if you're not, that's perfectly fine as well. Does that sound like a good plan moving forward with the recruitment stuff? Everyone in agreement with that?
And I would say if people can't make a meeting, like an extra meeting, feel free to have input with email back and forth. And I'm not sure if we can like do approval of bylaw changes or the charter in email or not, but I guess we could look at that. I think, Tim, you said something, but we didn't hear you.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, we can review this thing before we have another meeting, right? So let's say that, you know, everybody has 2 weeks to get comments in, and, you know, we send out a reminder a couple of days before, get all the comments in ahead of time, even without a meeting or before the meeting, the special meeting. That's just a thought.
We could go with the first Thursday of next month. First Thursday seemed to be the way we go.
It would be my preference to do the poll and see where people are at. I don't know, you know, with the special meeting, these ones I know were always first Thursdays, but for a special meeting, I'd like a little bit more flexibility personally. Okay. I think we'll go with the poll. We'll try to get some input. If you can't make the meeting, no pressures, and you can provide input via email. And let's move forward with the policy subcommittee. Travis, I know that's you, me, and Tim. I'll raise my hand. I've been slacking on it big time. And I know with COVID, there's really not a big push in the state legislature right now with anything related to solid waste. So maybe you could just give an update on kind of what you're hearing from the legislature on it quickly.
Yeah. In fact, and I want to make sure just for clarification, I think, is Jason, are you still involved in that as well?
Yeah, Jason was involved. Sorry, Jason.
Okay. No, that's fine. I just.
Yep.
Okay. So what I might do is maybe once you guys, there's really one bill up for interest, and not to put Jessica on the spot, but Jessica's provided some updates to you on the medication take back program. There is a bill that's looking at changing that and modifying things. So I think that one would be a really good one to bring to the SWAC to give Jessica, to give you a time to read it, to give a chance to hear Jessica's feedback and comments. And then the SWAC can determine whether or not it's something you want to act on or not. There are not a lot of legislative bills right now that are up for that really move the dial for us right now. There's a really cool one on recycling wind turbine blades and requiring that to happen. But Kyle, would you be open to, and Tim and Jason as well, be open to, I can send you an email with a summary. We'll do similar what you're doing with the bylaws. I'll send you the information. You can provide some comments on what you think. We can set up a meeting to talk about a strategy if it's something you want to move forward on, and then we would just come up with an action plan. It wouldn't take a lot, but I think it would probably be good to take some time to give you a heads up on looking at it, and then we can meet with the three of you and potentially Jessica to discuss the impact of the bill and what the county, what SWAC would like to do. Does that seem feasible? Does that seem like a decent approach given how you guys are also doing the charter?
Yeah, I think to me that sounds good. Jason, Tim?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll look for some info from you.
All right. I will tomorrow, I will put together an email and send you the bill. I'll work with Jessica on getting Jessica's initial comments out. That way you'll have time to read the review and then get the perspective of Jessica. And then we'll set up a time to chat. So I will make a note of that now.
Perfect. Thanks, Travis. Okay. We have a vacant chair position. So I guess open it up for discussion / nominations on a chair position.
Hey, Kyle, real quick before we move on, I'm sorry to interrupt
you. Sorry, Joe, go ahead. Nope, that's perfectly okay.
Subcommittees. I thought there was going to be a subcommittee put together about the traffic issue over on 117th Avenue. I had never heard anything that came about from that. Do you know anything about that?
So that will be part of the sorry, I was writing down the note and now I've lost track. That will be part of the next presentation from the regional system study. So a lot of the recommendations from the regional, and I just swore on camera again, didn't I? The regional system study presentation, a lot of the recommendations that you will hear about are based upon fixing that traffic problem, and that involves, you know, policy, some of what Derek mentioned earlier about improving. But that's going to be coming out of that next conversation and that presentation, whether it's a subcommittee is developed after that will probably be the timeline. But, Yes. So we will get to what you're discussing, Joe, but during the next presentation with J.R. Miller for the regional system study. And that's a big traffic conversation. So.
Oh, okay. Super. I'm sorry. I had kind of raised my hand, four or six months ago and then just never heard anything from it. So I just kind of lost track. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. No, you're still on the hook, Joe. We are appreciative of your volunteering and we will do that. And we'll get a schedule out to you soon. So thank you.
Yeah, they're not going to let you off the hook that easy.
Okay. Carry on, Kyle. Thank you.
All right. No problem. So opening up for discussion and nominations on a new chair since Steve resigned.
So doesn't our bylaws put you in as chair?
They do not.
Our bylaws do not. In the event of a vacancy in the position of chair, the vice chair will assume the position of chair to complete the remainder of the chair's term.
Okay, maybe it does it say that, Kim?
Is that a mic drop moment?
It might have been.
I'm reading right out of the bylaws.
This group's bylaws?
One that it says Clark County Solid Waste Advisory Commission, bylaws and rules. It's number 3C under officers.
Well, me too. I think, Kyle, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think your term's also expired since it's been a long time since the last meeting. And I think you all were up when we were supposed to meet last time.
I think so. The dates on the agenda, are those the dates of when our terms expire?
Those are your terms, not your officer position.
Oh, your officer. Yes, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Got it.
So I think you all are due for new chair and vice chair. And then what I'm going to do is I'll add to the agenda, like when that chair, like I have for your, that's a good idea. So I'll do that. So whoever's voted chair or vice chair, I'll add on the agenda when your term started so that we always make sure we know to vote for new folks on time.
So you're saying that Steve's position as chair would have expired or has expired?
Yeah.
So it sounds like we need discussion then on vice chair and chair and nominations for both positions because they've now expired. So
how do we do that? I mean, is that something we want to try and tackle here tonight?
I would like to, get it just done with. I think I'm willing to step up to one of the positions, whatever I'd be nominated for, and we would need a second person as well.
I'll nominate you as chair, if that's okay. I mean, Kyle, you've done a great job. Yeah.
I'm trying. I'm not really good at the Zoom meeting stuff, but
you're doing
we're figuring it out.
Yeah, if you'd be willing to do it, that'd be awesome, as long as the rest of the group agrees.
Okay, so we've got a nomination for chair. Alan seconds. Perfect. Do we have anyone who would nominate for vice chair?
I nominate Joe Zimmerman.
You can also nominate yourself.
Yeah, you can nominate yourself generally, usually. I apologize, but I am going to decline the nomination only because I have just recently become secretary of the Clark Kellett's Farm Bureau. And in fact, I haven't even begun my first meeting as secretary yet. So although I am very grateful, folks, I'm going to decline if you guys don't mind. Maybe at a later date I'll step up, but as of right now, I've got enough with Farm Bureau going on.
No problem, Joe.
You were almost 2 for 2, Tim.
I tried. I mean, I could throw another name in there.
I'm going to nominate Tim for vice chair since he's nominating everyone else.
That's why I wanted to throw other names out.
I beat you to the punch, Tim. Can someone second it real quick?
I would second Tim for vice chair.
Okay. Do we have to do votes, Kim, or can we just do it by what?
Yeah, unless the bylaws say otherwise, I'd really recommend a roll call vote. You can approve officers as a slate or Sorry, I don't have the bylaws in front of me. I should have done that. We can do one more call for any other nominations for chair or vice chair. If there's any out there, now's a good time to speak. Otherwise, I'd recommend an approval of the slate of both positions.
Okay. Last call for nominations. See none, hearing none. Moving on to a roll call vote, maybe by show of hands. You can make it easy on Zoom. Kyle Potter for chair. Perfect. And Tim Kraft for vice chair. All right. Congratulations, all the new elected.
I'll do vice chair under one condition, and that's that Kyle never misses a meeting.
I'll do my best. I'll do my best. I promise you that. I can't guarantee
it, but I'll do my best. You'll have your acceptance speeches prepared for the next meeting. Yeah, we can add that to the agenda.
We only require tuxedos on the top half. You only have to have the tuxedo top on. Don't worry about the pants.
Okay. Now that we've got our new chairs and vice chairs, our last item on the agenda is a public comment. I know that Philip was in the chat over here. Philip from Clark County Junk Removal. Did you want to do any public comment? If no, that's perfectly okay, but I saw you had joined our meeting tonight.
No public comment needed.
Okay, thanks for joining us tonight, Philip. Anyone else have any other public comment or good of the order from the committee?
I just wanted to make you all aware that me and Travis will reach out pretty soon here to ask for agenda items so we can get a head start on the agenda. So just start thinking about if there was something in particular that you wish would have been on the agenda today, your presenters that you would like to see, or whatever. We want to get started on the agenda at an earlier timeline so that we can start rounding up presenters or whatever we'll need.
Yeah, I think when, thanks for bringing that up, Kim. Kyle and Tim, when I follow up with you now that I know who the chair and the vice chair are related to the activities and the projects for 2021, I think it might be good to also just discuss with you what some possible trainings, tours, like what can we fit into this year versus kicking it down the road to when things are better. So what can we get in front of you as far as useful information and experiences? So that'll be part of our conversation for 2021. I'm hopeful that we can kind of maybe build out some agenda items for each meeting so that we know what's going to happen in, you know, November, and we know what's going to happen in May. We can give people a heads up. So.
Yep. I like that plan, Travis. Go ahead.
I just wanted to thank Philip for attending and also thank him for his introduction. And I appreciate the emphasis on sustainability as a provider for junk removal. I think that's really important. And I appreciate you taking the time to share that with us.
Appreciate that as well.
Second that. Thank you. Anyone else have any good of the order before we make a motion to adjourn? Slightly over time, not too bad. Half an hour. Sorry, guys.
Just grateful that you are all here. Thankful that you are.
Yeah, thanks for everyone for coming.
And grateful that after last year, everybody's still part of this group. So thank you very much.
All right. Are you puppy right around, Travis?
Yeah, it's puppy time. Puppy camera. No, I make it before you puppy.
He had his boy part stepped off, and he's under a lot of sedation right now. So I don't think I can get my sedated, neutered puppy in front of the camera. So next time, you can all see my new St. Bernard puppy.
And I will end the recording right now.